Celia. Lamina propria. And Marilyn Monroe. Muscularis mucosa. MM. Three components to the mucosa. And how about the two components of the muscularis externa? What are those? No, the muscularis externa, not the cerebellum. The inner circular layer and the outer longitudinal layer. What's found between those two layers?
Myenteric
plexus. Good, we're feeling good. That's great. Okay, keep those things in mind. The subdivisions of the muscularis externa and the subdivisions of the mucosa are important considerations as you do what? As you follow the mucosa from esophagus to rectum. And you're following the rest of the layers as well, but they're not as interesting. They're rather boring compared to the mucosa and stuff that's going on there. So last time, we were beginning our discussion of the small intestine, and our intent is to, again, keep following that mucosa, and in addition to that, identify the three major regions of the small intestine. The first one being the duodenum, and the last one being the ileum. In the lab, we're going to ask you to recognize each of those three on a final exam in the lab. So it's necessary to be able to make, identify some distinguishing features. So what do you know about the duodenum right now that distinguishes it from the rest of the small intestine? Runner's gland, right. What distinguishes the ileum from the rest of the GI tract? I mean, from the rest of the small intestine? Peyer's patches, excellent. Runner's gland, duodenum, Peyer's patches, ileum. What might you say about the jejunum then? Nothing. Say nothing. Yeah, because it doesn't have Kuhner's glands, then it doesn't have Peyer's patches. It does have gout, though. There's lymphoid nodules and lymphocytes all the way along there, beginning actually in the esophagus, but heavily concentrated in the ileum. Okay, and we said that we found that the small intestine begins at pylorus and ends in the region of the large intestine called the cecum. There's a valve there. You'll be looking at the cecum's gross anatomy. You'll be looking for the appendix. And you might be looking for that valve to all the way up possible the intestine. Mesentery is kind of perplexing, isn't it, so far? What's the difference between mesentery and peritoneum? What's the difference between peritoneum and mesothelium? And it's kind of a blur, isn't it? Well, what you're going to see in the gross anatomy lab when you open up the abdominal cavity is a shiny layer. Stick a little flashlight down there, shine it on the bowel, and the light reflects off it like it looks like saran wrap. And it's covering the loops of bowel, and it's called, this layer is called the mesentery. The peritoneum. The peritoneum. And where that peritoneum attaches to the body wall, it's called the mesentery. So the layer you see in gross anatomy is called the peritoneum, but part of that peritoneum attaches the organs to the posterior body wall so that we don't have, what's the term? We don't have bowels out, do we? When Hannibal Lecter opened up the abdominal cavity, the bowels don't fall out. Mesenteric arteries and veins. The superior mesenteric artery is the blood supply. Smaller intestine. Superior mesenteric. feet long. And what was the advantage of that? Surface area for absorption. Well, it turns out that the mucosa, if you stretch it out, is far longer than 18 to 20 feet. The tube on the outside surface may measure 18 feet long, but when you take the circular folds where the mucosa is folded up inside of that 18 feet of tube, like an accordion, you have significantly greater surface area than 18 feet represent. You're not going to see this until you get to gross anatomy, when you open up the small intestine and see that for yourself. One of our main goals today is to study the histology of the very, very famous intestinal villus. What is this thing? What happens to it in disease? What does the term villus suggest to you? A little finger-like thing. Villi is plural, villus singular, so many little finger-like things that are not found in the esophagus, not found in the stomach, and not found in the colon, large intestine. So this is the only chance to get here in the small intestine to look at this phenomenon, and I expect you to know quite a lot about it. What its advantages are, and what its structures are. Now, what you cannot see with the light microscope, you can see villi easily. What you can see with the light microscope in the lab is the surface of each columnar epithelial cell. And you can sort of see where it's at because adjacent cells have the same structure. And so if you look at several epithelial cells in a row, you get a sense that there's something up here, the lumen is up here. The basement membrane is down there. And these things, you remember, were microvilli. And what's the advantage of microvilli? Increases the surface area for absorption. And when you look at this structure along the surface of the epithelium, what name was given to a collection of microvilli found on adjacent cells?
Brush border.
A brush border. Are there any enzymes in there?
Yes.
Like what? Lactase? Sucrase? Maltase? There are some enzymes there that are very important for our digestion. We now are going to move on and talk about the rest story, and digestive glands are found, quote-unquote digestive glands, are found in the stomach, too. And they're part of the mucosa in the stomach, and now we have similar glands in the small intestine. But I'd like you to know the difference in function, especially, between these glands in the stomach and the glands in the small intestine. Be aware that the glands we're talking about are found in the mucosa. Where's Brunner's glands found? That's a very important question here, actually. It may not seem like it, but it is. What layer of the duodenum are his Brunner's glands found? Submucosa. See, we're talking about glands in the mucosa, so if you didn't notice that in lab, go back to the slide and check that out, because these glands are in the mucosa, but Brunner's glands in the submucosa. And if you don't make that distinction, then when you see Brunner's glands on the exam, you won't know that you're looking at the duodenum. That's an important distinction there. And the glands in the stomach, we call them gastric glands, didn't we? in those gastric glands. Trial cells and sheath cells, that's good. That's good. How many enzymes were manufactured in those gastric glands? Not many. One was what? Carcinogen, right? And hydrochloric acid by the product. And there are some other enzymes there, too. How about in the digestive glands of the small intestine? We're in this area of big-time digestion and big-time absorption. When we look at these intestinal glands, digestive glands in the mucosa of the small intestine, are we going to find many digestive enzymes being made there? Tara says, what? No. Isn't that weird? Here we have these so-called digestive glands in the small intestine, and they're not making many digestive enzymes. There are some digestive enzymes up in here, though, aren't there? But let's look at these glands now. Find them and see what they look like. And really, as far as we're concerned, the only valuable feature of these glands is that it helps you recognize them on the lab exactly.
In the intestines, there's glands in the mucosa and the
skin. Yeah. Yeah, the question, Matt, right?
Yeah.
The question Matt has is, in the small intestine, we have glands both in the mucosa and the submucosa, and that's correct. And that's what reason I'm asking the question. In the small intestine, can you name some glands in the submucosa? Runner's gland. Can you name some glands in the mucosa? Yeah, the crypts of Leverkusen, the intestinal crypts. They're not in the submucosa. They're in the mucosa. And that's an important recognition because it helps you orient yourself to what layer you're actually looking at. So we're going to answer these questions. These are learning objectives here. We're going to answer these questions here in the next few slides. Well, how are the crypts related to villi? How are the crypts related to lamina? How are the crypts related to muscularis mucosa? And so let's see. Before we do, what is the epithelium? How do you characterize or identify the epithelium of the small intestine? Simple columnar epithelium. Simple columnar epithelium. And we have to see how that epithelium is arranged in the intestinal villus. And we're going to have to see how this epithelium in the small intestine, in the mucosa, is arranged within the glands. So that simple columnar epithelium of the mucosa of the small intestine covers the villus and goes down into the glands. Let's see how that happens. First of all, let's look at these circular folds. This is not only a fold of the mucosa, but there's some submucosa in there as well. Both mucosa and submucosa. But the muscle layer doesn't go into the folds. The muscularis externa stays on the outside. So if I were to draw the muscularis externa on the photograph here, I would draw the muscularis externa as a continuous layer along this line. But in the folds themselves, there would be only mucosa and submucosa. We're not going to see any more of those folds. So that's the end of the story there. So, in fact, you're not going to see them very well in lab, although there is a slide, one slide in your slide box that shows these things, but it's not an important structure compared to this. And you see the little wiggly fingers. Now, what epithelium covers the surface of each of these little fingers projecting into the lumen of the small intestine? What was that epithelium? Not drawn here, it is down here. Simple columnar epithelium. Now, what are these holes, do you think? Intestinal glands. And so the epithelium is covering the villus. You can see here the epithelium is covering the villus. A continues on down into those holes as the crypts or intestinal gland. What does that remind you of in the stomach? The opening into the gastric pit. But in the stomach, are there any of these little fingers poking up from the openings in the gastric pit? No. No, the stomach lumen is smooth, except for the holes, of course. But here in the small intestine, we have the added feature of these villi, which increase the surface area for absorption. Notice the lamina propria is found around the gland. Notice the lamina propria is found in the villus. And why would you have made that prediction? That's true. How might you have predicted that that's lamina propria here and that's lamina propria there? Because it's touching the epithelium. It's touching the basement membrane of the epithelium. And so that's an easy recognition, isn't it? Here's an intestinal crypt. One of these babies there. And over here is the finger. Intestinal villus. And you can see over the villus here. And down in the crypt there, over the villus, simple lumnar epithelium with brush border. Here they call it the triad border. Over here, down in the crypt, now down in the intestinal gland, we still have simple lumnar epithelium. And there are some interesting cells down in these so-called intestinal glands or intestinal crypts. They're labeled for you there. Canna cell. We're going to talk a little bit about that. Talk a little bit about the canna cell. And keep note of this one here. The cell that can divide by mitosis. And remember our neuroendocrine cells. Name one in the stomach. Name one in the pylorus of the stomach. G cell makes what? Gastrin. Excellent. We have them down here too, don't we? Neuroendocrine cells. And canna cells. Let's talk about these a little bit later. Let's go look at the villus here. And we'll see that it's got simple columnar epithelium as its outer surface. Are there any other cells in there besides these columnar cells? Goblet cells. Any goblet cells in the stomach? Any mucus secreting cells in the stomach?
Yes.
Wow. Great. So there's goblet cells in the small intestine, and here's kind of the rule of thumb. The rule of thumb is that as we go from duodenum to colon, the population of goblet cells increases almost logarithmically. There's an increased number of goblet cells as we move from duodenum ileum, and then into the colon, large intestine. The duodenum has very few goblet cells. The jejunum has more. The ileum has even more. And when you look at the large intestine, you think they're all goblet cells. That's useful, isn't it? Well, it's useful for lab, but it's useful for anything else. But it's a very useful thing to think about for a laboratory. We're going to see that some of the older generation cells, the oldest cells, are being pushed off into the lumen here. So they detach and die from apoptosis. Now, where would they be sloughing off in this picture? All the old cells are right here, and they're going to die, and they're going to end up in the lumen and are gone forever. So is the epithelium of our small intestine then decreasing in cell count throughout our life? No, because we have all this new generation of cells being formed down here where we have stem cells, mitotic cells. The stem cells for this epithelium are located down in the intestinal crypt, intestinal gland. And the adolescent cells are pushed up. And as new cells form and the adolescent cells are pushed up, the middle-aged cells move up here, and then the elderly are up at the tip. And then genocide appears as the younger generation pushes them off the cliff. To the PC. Well, that's terrible story. Micrometer diameter structure that is on its way, most of them anyway, slightly different story, and it's really not a big deal, but the stem cells are not found down in the glands, actually. They're found in the region called the neck. Well, they're found at the base of the gastric hip. They're found at the base of the gastric hip, or right next to that, those mucus-secreting surface cells. And when they divide, some go this way, and some go that way. So these stem cells then could form surface mucus cells, or these stem cells could differentiate into these stem cells going down the glands could differentiate into maybe two cells.
Chief
cells and parietal cells. You could differentiate into chief cells or parietal cells. Does this take a month for this process to complete? What does this tell you up here about how often your epithelium of your intestines are renewed by totally new population of cells? How often is your epithelium replaced in your small intestine? About a week, huh? Within a week, you have all new, brand spanking new epithelial cells. That's nice. That's really cool. Look at where these patent cells are. We still don't know enough about patent cells. We should know more. We're not going to ask you to find them in the lab, although they're easy to see. Well, maybe we will ask them. Right? They're really easy to see because they hang out right next to. Muscularis mucosae down there. And what do they do? Well, one thing that they seem to do is produce some antimicrobial substances, especially antibacterial substances. And one of those substances that have been found as a secretion is called lysozyme, which is somewhat of a non-specific antibacterial substance, like a enzyme, sort of. And it belongs to our natural immunity, our innate immunity. Other than that, we're not quite so sure about what's going on there. So there's a function of patent cells. They're located down at the base of the intestinal glands, next to the muscle. And their secretions, some of their secretions, seem to be antibacterial in nature. Other than that, we're not quite sure. They probably do a lot of other things, too. Keep aware that goblet cells are going to be increasing in concentration as you go down to or direct them. And what's their function? Production of mucus makes the stuff slippery. Avid cells are found, we call them neuroendocrine cells as well. And of course, they are found in the epithelium rather randomly, not generally in the villus, not generally in a gastric pit, but within gastric glands and within intestinal glands. And where would you expect their secretions to go? Into the lumen of the gut, or where? Into the bloodstream. And what was your first clue? The word endocrine. The word endocrine in the name. And there's a bunch of various functions of secreting neurotransmitter-like substances and hormone-like substances. And the only one we've encountered so far, specifically in our discussion, is the G cell producing what again?
Gastric.
Yeah. We saw a picture like this for the stomach, and now I have a comparable one for the small intestine. And you'll see the god-awful name for these intestinal glands here. Isn't that a silly name? Crypts of Libra. Why do they continue on using found on the intestinal villus up there. Look at all those little wavy fingers there. There's a lymphoid nodule. Where is it in this picture? What layer?
The lamina propria.
Indeed. Your toes are right on the lamina propria.
Okay.
And for some of these lymphoid nodules are going to be in the subcutaneous. Lamina propria, what is its specific composition? Well, it is, what kind of connective tissue? Loose connective tissue, great. And in this lamina propria of the villus, we might find these lymphatic vessels that have a special name. And these lymphatic vessels might be loaded with chylomicron from processing fat. Capillaries will also be arranged within that villus as a capillary bed. I've got some pictures coming up. And the connective tissue, of course, is areolar or loose connective tissue. Remember the meaning of the term GALT? What does that mean? Gut-associated lymphoid tissue found throughout the digestive tract. But where is it concentrated most again? In the ileum. Has what? Iron patches. These are both lymphoid follicles containing B cells and some additional diffuse T cells. We're going to talk in a minute about a fascinating cell that's located primarily, not exclusively, but primarily where Peyer's patches is found. So these M cells, as they're called, they're found mostly in areas where lymphoid follicles are concentrated, where that's going to be in Peyer's patches. What do they do? And how are they related to the basement membrane? Well, these M cells are right in the epithelium. So they would be located right adjacent to their big brother here, and the basement membranes here. And they'll have a very interesting kind of structure to them. Like so. It's a very interesting structure to an M cell. Looks like an umbrella kind of cell. And so we're going to encounter that here shortly. Pictures, and we'll see what we think it does. What are the various functions of the lamina propria? Yes.
What was that thing that you were talking about? That was a lymphatic vessel that might have a chylomicron thing.
Lacteal. The question is, what is this thing up here, lacteal? And the answer is, it's the lymphatic vessel that receives chylomicrons. So that they can be, where would those chylomicrons end up? They're in a lymphatic vessel in the small intestine. What do you think the next structure might be that these lacteals or these chylomicrons would encounter?
Cistern.
Well, not quite. There's something in the way. There's a filter on the way to the lymph node. And then eventually the cistern is highly rapid and so forth. And where would those chylomicrons dump in the bloodstream? Right here in the left subfavian vein, right? And there's a little over here going in the subfavian vein. So they eventually use the bloodstream. And so the blood supply there in the lamina propria is useful for absorbing most of our foodstuffs. And some of our fat goes into the bloodstream there. But a lot of it, of course, goes into the lacteal. In the lamina propria, we're going to see the manufacturing, in the lamina propria, manufacturing of a very important substance for our health. And it's an immunoglobulin, but we're going to refer to it as immunoglobulin A. And there are various forms of immunoglobulin that we'll encounter later. And when this immunoglobulin A reaches the lumen, when the immunoglobulin A, an antibody, reaches the lumen, it is a very somewhat complex molecule that has several parts to it. And when it of origin you would predict would be what cell? Plasma cell. And why did you predict that? Because they make antibodies. Right, plasma cells make antibodies. So we're going to find some plasma cells in the lamina propria. And we already did quite a long time ago in some of our PowerPoint slides when we were looking at this. We'll follow that story a little bit here coming up. And of course, there are lacteals in the lamina propria as well. IG, immunoglobulin is another word for antibody. Immunoglobulin. It's abbreviated up there. Capital I, little g, immunoglobulin. And that is a form of an antibody that we talked about when we were talking about the immune system earlier. What other antibodies did we talk about earlier? IgG, immunoglobulin G, and IgE we talked about a little bit, and talked about allergies and IgEs. We had a brief reference to IgMs, so there are different kinds of antibodies, different forms of immunoglobulin. This is the one that we sometimes refer to as our mucosal antibody, because it's found on mucosal surfaces. Well, I guess this slide came sooner than I thought. In your textbook on page 503 is this picture. And on page 544 is the picture on the left. And as I promised, here's that sneaking word I don't like, enterocyte. It's a simple columnar epithelial cell. And like these over here, it's got Bart Simpson's hairdo. Just like all the other ones there. Flat top, microvillous hairdo. So what's going on in the lamina propria here? I see a plasma cell. And that plasma cell secretes a immunoglobulin molecule that for now we'll call the monomer. And we saw a cartoon of this a couple weeks ago, didn't we? When we were talking about the immune system. That's a classic immunoglobulin structure. Not very accurate because it's symbolic, but that's okay. What happens? The plasma cell is loaded with an organelle that produces a protein for export. And what is that fascinating organelle that all cells have for export of proteins? The rough ER and the Golgi. The rough ER and the Golgi just crammed into that plasma cell really, really tight. And in the lamina propria, these IgA molecules dimerize. And now we have sort of like two IgA molecules attached at their FCN, attached by a substance we'll call the J protein, I guess. So it dimerizes. And then an interesting thing happens. This FC end of the antibody, I think we talked about the FC end of the antibody before. Which part of this antibody is selective for the antigen? Is it up here? Or is it down there? Up here. Antigen here we talked about. Well, this region of the molecule is called the FC end of the molecule. FC end. And you see that when it dimerizes, the FC ends of this one and the FC ends of that one are kissing. They're face to face. FC. FACE, face to face. What happens next? Well, the immunoglobulin A dimer still has the ability to bind to an FC receptor. So what is a receptor in a cell membrane? Is it fat?
Protein.
A protein. You have a protein or a glycoprotein in the cell membrane, and it's got a little thing waving out there that says, come and get me, IgA, I'm right over here. And they attach, Christ be a divert internalized into the entrance, right? And transported into the vesicle. Be a gift, isn't it? It is not a full-fledged one of these yet. But, well, sort of, but not quite. Yeah, it is. And going toward the surface, transported up there, and then this IG molecule that is now secreted from the erythrocyte is appropriate to be called I am an IG molecule that has been secreted. Secreted by the erythrocyte, so we'll call it secretory IgA. And then you can find it on the surface of the drug border and in the lumen. And probably can be useful, can it, to bind to antigen in our food, maybe. Well, that's not an M cell. We haven't got to the M cell yet. So let's see how the capillaries are arranged in the villus. Intense capillary bed with an arterial and a venule and a bunch of little capillaries. And also, in that same villus, if we were to draw the lacteal in that same villus, it's not very clear, is it? So the artist didn't do that, but there's a lacteal. There's a lacteal in this villus. Just gets a little cluttered after a while. And there's even some smooth muscle cells, but we don't care too much about that. Notice that a lymphoid follicle, if it's in this region of the lamina propria, is also intensely surrounded by lymphatic vessels. What's that? And of course, we have a submucosal complexum. Well, this lymphoid follicle here is partly in the lamina propria and partly in the submucosa, and that fact helps you understand the position of Peyer's patches. Peyer's patches is partly in the submucosa, partly in the lamina propria. We'll see that here in a second. Okay, let's look at this M cell. And if you want to see a little more, a little more three-dimensional drawing, go to your textbook. This picture doesn't come from your textbook, like most of your pictures do. But if you go to page 553 in Ross, you can see a three-dimensional drawing of this. It's kind of slick. And some scanning electron microscopy. What do you see here? Well, I see plasma cells in the lamina propria down here. And I see over here a lot of lymphocytes in the lamina propria. And let's pretend that these lymphocytes here are part of Peyer's patches. And you'll notice that in the region of Peyer's patches in the ileum, the basal lamina is discontinuous and full of holes. And that allows lymphocytes ready access into the umbrella of the M cell. So we can see lymphocytes here, B cells, mostly, I guess, although there could be some T cells, but they're up here and they manage to have access, I guess, through that fully basic membrane. And now they're right up here near the antigens, aren't they? And they're right up near the secretory IgA. They're right up here close to the action, aren't they? Because when they're down here, they're far from the action up there. Well, what does the M cell do? Well, what do we think it does? We think that it might trap antigenic substances from our diet, well, or some antigens that have entered by way of the mouth and down through the digestive tract. And these antigens can be transported across the cytoplasm into the vicinity of the lymphocytes that are right there. Sounds handy to me a little bit. So this cell sometimes, M cell, is sometimes called a antigen transporting cell. But it was discovered that these cells have MHC class 2 molecules. And go back and look at those pictures of the HLA molecules in your previous PowerPoint slide. When a cell has an MHC class 2 molecule is oftentimes described as an antigen-presenting cell. So people now are calling the M cell an antigen-presenting cell. And to whom are they presenting the antigens? two. The lymphocytes, to the lymphocytes, presenting the antigen to the lymphocytes for what purpose, possibly? To mount and reaction. Here's a scanning electron microscopy picture of this over here. So pretend you're up here hanging from the letter C on a rope and looking down. You're a little tiny person now. And you're looking down. Well, what the next picture shows is that all of this epithelium was removed. So you're still up here looking down. The epithelium's gone, and so what you're looking at directly is the basal lamina in the next picture. All the cells of the epithelium have been erased, and you're looking down on the membrane, basal lamina, and you can see. And the intent of this picture was to demonstrate that the basement membrane over a lymphoid follicle is like a sieve. And so there might be buried deep in here a lymphoid nodule, deep to the surface. On the other side of the screen, deep to the surface, is a lymphoid follicle of Peyer's patches. And over there on the right would be the basal lamina overlying another lymphoid nodule and so forth. And look how porous and sieve-like this basal lamina is. Now what's this over here? Well, that's basal lamina too. But it's not sieve-like. Now, why is it dark there? Well, because the basal lamina goes up and down a little bit, so you can't see down in those shadows there. But the point they're trying to make here is that the basal lamina is not sieve-like, except where the basal lamina is found between the holes. The basal lamina is only sieve-like between a lymphoid follicle of Peyer's patches and an M cell, or multiple M cells. So, on the other side of the screen in this picture would be a lymphoid follicle. On the front side of the screen would be an M cell, or multiple M cell. Actually, multiple M cells over the top. You can see that this porosity enhances the chances of an immune reaction being initiated in the region of Peyer's patches. Okay, so let's move on. Let's take a break, and then we'll move on after the break. About 10 minutes. 10 minutes break. Cell cannot manufacture this Fc receptor. make this work. The cell that makes the antibody and the cell that makes the secretory component. They both have to be present, and they both have to be properly structured in order for this antibody to get out into the lumen. So hopefully that straightened up a few questions there. All you got to do is read the text on page 503 and 504, and you're all set. All right. Next subject is what are Bruner's glands, or I might translate that by saying, what is the principal histological feature of the duodenum? And that principal feature of the duodenum, which is right next to what organ? Stomach and the jejunum. Stomach on one end and the jejunum on the other. Right next to the stomach. And so the stomach is going to empty now at some point. And all this time that the stomach has been churning around and about for half an hour or more, an hour maybe, now it jumps out of the stomach and enters up here in the lumen of the duodenum. Okay, so let's call it time. And what's the first thing that has to happen to that time as it enters the environment of the duodenum? Neutralize that pH in order for the enzymes to work. And Bruner's glands helps with that. Bruner's glands secretes mucus, no doubt about it, but it also secretes a lot of bicarbonate, a buffer, bicarbonate buffer, to help in this buffering. Buffer also comes from the pancreas, and I need a lot of buffer here because the pH was very low in the stomach. So some of it comes from Bruner's glands, and some of it comes from pancreas, and a little bit of added by the, I can't believe I'm saying this, but a little bit added by the enterocytes of the epithelium. So lots of sources of bicarbonate. Bruner's gland is found primarily in the submucosa, even though Harrischenko's drawing shows it up here. And this becomes confusing to the student because the green arrow is muscularis mucosae. So above here would be connective tissue of the lamina propria, and below here would be connective tissue of the submucosa. The artist has drawn Bruner's glands in both compartments. Above the muscularis mucosa would be in the lamina propria, and down below would be the submucosa. That's confusing. There are a few goblet cells. You can see some little light bulbs. White goblets. There's a few in the duodenum. And here's a little better drawing, I think, because it shows the fact that the muscularis mucosa, I'll draw it here, it smooths up the cells in red. Again, I want to emphasize what a major landmark that is for your study in histology lab. That's a major landmark always. Because it's the inner boundary of the mucosa. And appropriately drawn here, or not drawn, but photographed in Ross, is the fact that the submucosa here contains Bruner's glands, either tubular and acinar, mainly tubular mucus secreting cells. What suggests to you that these glands down here, exocrine glands, are mucus secreting? How about this picture? What suggests that they're mucus secreting to you? The pale color, yeah, the white, ghosty, pale color to the cell. In the old days, we used to expect the students to recognize all three regions of the small intestine, duodenum, jejunum, ileum, by the appearance of the villi. But now we can no longer get adequate slides of where the villi are still intact. So if you were looking at villi already in lab, you'll see that some slides show really good villi, and others they're destroyed and damaged by some sort of inflammatory process. So we can't ask you to identify duodenum, jejunum, ileum by their villi anymore, shaving villi, because most of the time they're destroyed. So that leaves us with Bruner's gland. finger there. Everybody say it together. Lacteal. Lacteal. And what is that thing again?
A
lymphatic vessel taking up chylomicron. Lacteal. Lacteal. There's going to be a lot of capillaries up there as well. Identify the tissue that surrounds the lacteal. Lamina propria? No, that's not the tissue. Identify the tissue. Loose connective tissue. Name the tissue. Lamina propria. Get that system there again? The name of it's lamina propria. The identity of the tissue is loose connective tissue. And the fresh border is labeled SB, I guess. Striated border or fresh border. Do it jejunum, no Brenner's gland, and no Peyer's patches. There's ileum. Peyer's patches are outlined in this dotted, broken line, I guess. And there's a follicle here, a follicle here, one there, one here, one here, one here, and there you've got a germinal center, I think, in the center. And there's a follicle there. And there's probably an edge of a follicle here, so I'll put it there whether I can see it or not. So these are all lymphoid follicles congregated in a city called Peyer's patch. Now there's going to be lots of lymphocytes also up in the villi. And there's going to be M cells in this vicinity as well. In the ileum, we have far more godless cells. And of course, lots of them. There's lots of loose connective tissue. I don't see a lacteal here. The cut didn't go through a lacteal, I guess. We even have godless cells down in the intestinal crypts. There's a G for a godless cell right there. And this is muscular as mucosa down here, and that's lamina propria. There'd be a lot of plasma cells up in here. Up in here, all of this is lamina propria.
Are there M cells throughout the
spine? Actually, there are M cells throughout, but they're primarily concentrated in the epithelium where Peyer's patches is right here. Primarily in the epithelium. Okay. Big intestine. That's a really good question. Matt asked, how do we know we're looking at a lacteal? Well, and the reason that question is worth asking is because that could be an artifact of preparation. And a lot of times there might be a space in the villus where that happens. And so if we were to label this on a lab final exam, we would label something like that, whether it's a real lacteal or not, whether it's a shrinkage artifact, whether it's a big open white space, it doesn't matter. One thing is for sure, this white space is not part of this, because it's surrounded by loose connective tissue, and there would be an endothelium, which you will never see. So the question's a good one. How are you going to know if it's a lacteal? Well, that endothelial state layer is so thin, you have no hopes of seeing it. So, I guess the way I would answer the question is, if you find a big space in the villus, we're going to assume it's a lacteal. Alright. So what do we have to know about the large intestine to distinguish it from the rest of the gut? Well, part of that is function. Does the large intestine digest anything?
No.
Large intestine absorb anything?
Yes.
Yeah, water. It absorbs a lot of water, but it doesn't digest much. Most of our digestion is enabled in the small intestine. So it of course, is described, the function is described as not only absorbing water, but excreting the feces in a complicated process involving single subdivisions of the large intestine. Well, as you see this question, you might think, is Fredrickson talking about histological regions, or are we talking about naked eye gross anatomy regions? Well, there are no histological differences. There's nothing like ileum, jejunum, and duodenum. There's nothing like that in the large intestine, where there's a significant histological difference in the small intestine. So the divisions of the large intestine are basically gross anatomic divisions. The part that goes up is called the ascending cloaca. The part that goes across is called the transverse cloaca. The part that goes down is descending. So ascending, transverse, descending, sigmoid after that. Sigmoid cloaca. So here they are. The cecum is part of the ascending cloaca. I have it separated here. Cecum is where the ileum is attached, but we're going to include the cecum as part of the ascending colon. And there's transverse colon, descending colon, sigmoid colon, and after the sigmoid colon comes the rectum. I need a little work on this slide. After the sigmoid colon is the rectum. What's the difference? Well, the rectum is lined by stratified squamous epithelium. And the sigmoid colon is not. The sigmoid is single colonar epithelium. And of course, the appendix is attached to the cecum. There. That's what needs to work on this. Always right. Well, the rectum actually has some simple columnar, but in the rectum there is a transition point between simple columnar, somewhere in the rectum, transition point between simple columnar and stratified squamous. We're not going to look at rectum in lab. What are the general functions? Absorption of fluids, secretion of mucus, or lubrication, I guess. Oh, what's all this about? What do you need to know about that? Do we have bacteria in our large intestine? Yes. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Good thing, or sometimes bad, depending on what the bacteria are. But generally, it's a good thing, huh? How about if we take a broad spectrum antibiotic and kill all the bacteria in the colon? So what? I hate those little buggers anyway. What's going to happen now? Now you'll see what you might see happen is after the antibiotic wears off, but there's a number of things that are going to happen. But one thing that might happen is after the antibiotics have been purged from your body, some new bacteria start growing. And they may not be friendly. They may be pathogenic bacteria. And sometimes some bacteria don't respond to the antibiotics. And the bottom line is, we want friendly bacteria. We don't want pathological bacteria in the colon. And taking broad-spectrum antibiotics might result in the growth of some unfriendly bacteria. Anybody know what else the bacteria do there besides being symbiotic? If they're symbiotic, what does that mean? We allow them to live, and they provide something for us. What do they provide for us? Well, prevention of deadly infections, that's one. That's not what I'm getting at. They make vitamin K. They make vitamin K. And some other vitamins, too. Mainly vitamin K. And vitamin K is important in the liver, where the liver makes blood clotting proteins that are vitamin K dependent. If we're vitamin K deficient, we can't clot our blood. but we will bleed to death relatively quickly. There are vitamin K dependent blood clotting protein made in the liver. Rat poison called warfarin. Decon is called it, and if you're a certain brand of warfarin, Decon. Warfarin blocks vitamin K, and so the rat becomes bloody and dehydrated and dies. That may be true. That's useful information. I hadn't heard it. I do know that the bacteria certainly has a population of bacteria because it's part of the colon. The appendix looks physiologically just like the colon, except it's got more gulp in it. But I knew there was bacteria there, but I didn't know that there would be a source to reseed. So sounds good. Reseed the colon after taking something that would destroy bacteria. That's cool.
Very cool. I have a question. Dr. Ferguson, do some of these bacteria digest things that we can't normally digest?
Yeah, sometimes the bacteria are also help with the formation of the feces. And most of it's apparently helping with processing bilirubin. Because, well, one of the things it does is the bacteria. Remember the bilirubin was made in the spleen by destroying red cells? The bacteria produce things that help convert bilirubin to a substance that makes the feces look brown. Why does the feces look brown? Because of bilirubin. Bilirubin makes the feces look brown. So if somebody's got liver problem and pancreas problem and you can't get bile down into the gut, what color will the feces be in this patient? Chalky white. Chalky white color. And so that's an important clinical tool, isn't it? If you have a patient that complains of chalky white stool, then you start thinking, where does the bilirubin go? And why isn't it there? That sort of thing. Warfarin. We give humans rat poison. What is it called? Coumadin. Coumadin is warfarin, rat poison. Why would we give somebody Coumadin? So that the blood doesn't clot so easily, so that we can break up any thrombus that might occlude a blood vessel. What are some specific histological features of the colon? Well, we're kind of abbreviating our discussion by making a list of histological differences here, and so very importantly, the epithelium in the colon is not arranged with lamina propria and villi. There are no villi. like the Audubon. It looks like the Great Wall of China. And notice it runs as a fairly uniform diameter strip at the particular width to it. And it is an extra muscle layer. An extra little strip of muscle found on the outside surface while it's beneath the serosa. The outside surface of the muscularis externa helps recognize the colon in a gross anatomy setting. Here's a house truck from this little groove here to this little groove here. And so the colon is kind of arranged like little boxcars. In that house truck, the colon can compact. Ever seen a compactor in action in your kitchen? A food compactor or a garbage compactor? Compacting. What's it compacting?
Trash.
What do you call individual segments of feces? Called turds. Sorry. A little segment of feces. And it's compacting. In this thing called a house truck. Now packaging it up for elimination. Don't see any Okay, so let's look at the colon from Arashenko's atlas, and there really isn't much to say about it. The way you recognize it is by looking at the mucosa, just like every place else. The recognition is primarily, well, except for small intestine, primarily in the mucosa. So that means you better darn well find the muscularis mucosae as a major landmark, so you know where you're at. There are no extensive submucosal glands. Lots of blood vessels and capillaries and neurons, just like the submucosa every place else. Not a whole lot of glands. You might find some gulp, but not like fire patches. What's the trick here? The clue to identifying the colon is to look at these glands right here. Here's the opening, and the gland runs all the way down to the muscularis mucosa. Here's another one. The intestinal gland begins at the surface called the crypt. Now, the crypt runs all the way from the lumen all the way down to the muscularis mucosa. Here's another one here. Opening right here. And it runs all the way down. So the only places you have surface epithelium is right here. You have a little surface epithelium there. Or another way of saying it is that the colon has a smooth surface here. A very, very smooth, no villi at all. A very smooth, uniform surface with a bunch of holes in it. In other words, just like the stomach. Just like the stomach. And so that's sometimes a confusion. Is this the colon I'm looking at on the exam, or is this the stomach I'm looking at on the exam? So now you have to add an additional feature. Stomach has no little light bulbs. Stomach has no goblet cell. So even though there might be some similarities, and there's another thing that's different about the stomach, it's divided into gastric pits and gastric glands. So be aware of that difference. But in the colon, there's no such thing as a pit. It's all gland. It's gland from the surface all the way down to the muscularis mucosa and the lamina propria separates each of those glands. There's no gastric pit. The gland runs all the way from the lumen throughout the entire thickness of the mucosa. And that's all you need for lab to identify the colon. See these little test tubes, these little finger-like test tubes running all the way from the lumen down to the muscle. Pretty simple. And all kinds of goblet cells. So what's this? Well, we're standing up here down at our feet. Looking down at our feet. And let's see what we see. What's the green arrow pointing at?
That's cool.
The opening into the gland. We're looking at the opening into the intestinal tract. Not in the gastric tract. That's not a gastric tract. Although you would never know it from this picture. This could look very much like the stomach in a picture like this. We're looking at the opening. Looking at these openings. These are round holes, and you can't see that from this picture. These are round holes. And the gland is going down through the mucosa, all the way down through the muscularis mucosae. And here's a little mucus popping out of that, coming right out of there, like snot out of a nostril there. And out of that hole, that mucus. It's almost Thanksgiving. That's the last slide. Don't worry about this. EDA will do this in pathology. One of the tumor markers for colon cancer, is a marker called CEA, and the pathologist would stain a lump of colon that was taken out the biopsy and see whether it stains positive or not. Don't worry about this. I just want you to be aware that we're going to talk about this next year when we talk about colon cancer. So we have some time here. We're going to go on to the next slide. Yes?
On the colon, could another identified feature be that it has more folds?
No. There are far more folds in the mucosa of the stomach and the small intestine. There are some folds in the colon, and you did see that, and I did point it out. It was on one of the slides. There are some folds, but not nearly as extensive as any of the other areas. We should look at gland. Now, I thought for a while last night that we were going to deliver first, but it turns out that's the back end of this handout. So it looks like liver and pancreas are on the agenda for next Wednesday. We'll pass up a week from today. We'll be doing liver. Is that the last day of class?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're going to do kidney in physiology class. We'll come in and visit you in physiology and talk about kidney at the appropriate time. That makes sense, doesn't it? When you're talking about renal physiology, let's come in and talk about renal histology. And it makes for a much better integration. So it works out that way. We've already looked at salivary glands in histology lab. Actually, a couple times. When we talked about exocrine glandular epithelium, and then when you were looking at a tooth and tongue, the bottom of that page was salivary gland. And in the lab, you will be asked to distinguish between among the three major salivary glands. And you might remember that one of those salivary glands has all mucus, acinius, and one of those salivary glands has only serous secreting units, and then one of them is mixed. Which one of those salivary glands has mixed mucus and serous? Submandibular. Which one has all mucus? Sublingual. And how about the parotid? All serous. Which one should you start with in your memorization process? Well, I like to start with the one that's mixed, so I can eliminate submandibular from my memory. The submandibular has mixed mucus and serous, and it's a big one under the mandible here, and now I'm done with that one. So then what's left? Parotid, all serous, sublingual, all mucus. Parotid, all serous, sublingual, all mucus, and submandibular mixed. This is just to emphasize the fact that you again need to think about serous secreting units, serous acinus, and you have to be able to distinguish a mucus acinus. And that's a really nice drawing, isn't it? Really nice drawing.
Sorry, I have a question about the colon.
epithelium is simple columnar above, and then it becomes stratified squamous down below. Yeah, sorry about that. Alrighty. So, salivary glands, major ones have names. Parotid, submandibular, sublingual. But we have also a bunch of other minor ones. Let's think about some minor ones. Oh, the labial glands makes my lip wet. Labial glands. And what else? Oh, the glands of von Ebner. The glands of von Ebner. Where are they at? In the tongue. In the tongue. Yeah, so those are some minor glands, and there's some other ones, too, spread throughout the oral cavity. Parotid, submandibular, sublingual, the ones that we're going to deal with. And then the minor ones. We named a couple, von Ebner and labial, but there are a lot of others. What's the histological structure of the parotid gland? Well, it's located below the ear and in front of the ear. Actually, a little bit behind, too. So right around the ear. And when it gets infected with a virus of a particular type, we call the disease mumps. Mumps is an infection of the parotid gland, primarily. And there's a duct from the parotid gland that sometimes gets stones in it. Boy, that hurts like the devil. When a stone gets in that Stenson duct, that duct opens up into your oral cavity right next to your upper second molar. Second molar on the upper teeth back there. And if you open your mouth and look in the mirror, you can see the opening just from Stenson's duct right in your own mouth. Sometimes measles causes inflammation of that duct, and so in physical clinical diagnosis, you'll encounter the disease that causes inflammation of that duct there. Physical diagnostic tool. This is a compound tubulo-abscinar gland. Remember, abscinus and obulus mean the same thing in this study. Compound tubulo-abscinar or tubulo-obular. Serous asthmae mostly, 99%, and around this abscinus in glands of various types, you can see right here, especially around serous asthmae, right next to the basement membrane, there's a cell that's named myoepithelium. Why would anybody call it a myoepithelial cell? It's in the epithelium, and it's contractile. It's a muscle contractor, a myoepithelial cell, a cell in the epithelium, right in the basement membrane, right in the basement membrane. And why would it contract? Tell me what happens when the baby is on the nipple. And a mother lactating, baby sucking on the nipple, why does the milk get into the baby's mouth? Is it the sucking pressure, or is it a stimulus of the skin around the nipple? Well, it's both. A little stimulus around the skin of the nipple, and the myoepithelial cells in the milk gland contract, and the milk goes gushing out the nipple. And myoepithelial cell is absolutely essential for the ejection of the secretion, whether it be saliva from your salivary glands or whether it be milk from the nipple. An important, important cell. And it's stimulated by some hormones in the female for what's called the milk letdown reaction as the milk goes squirting out of the secretory asthma. And of course, you've already seen extracurricular ducts, and you know that they've got a large lumen, and the acid. secretion. It's going to end up in the lumen, and then it's going to end up in this tiny duct, and it's going to end up in the parotid gland. No mucus cells here. Look at that nucleus there. There's a plastic section. That's what looks good. Look at that round nucleus there. Look at that round nucleus there. That's like a perfect dime shape. Dime-shaped nucleus. Perfectly round. Here's another one. How about the submandibular gland? It's located in the mandible. That's what they tell you. And it's excretory duct. It's called Wharton's duct. And there's two of them, just like there's two Stenson's ducts. There's two Wharton's ducts underneath your tongue. And you can lift your tongue up into that. And you look under that tongue. And there's two little ridges on the underside of your tongue that come from the submandibular gland called Wharton's duct. And those two little ridges have a little enlargement on the end. And so if you looked on the underside of the tongue, you might see a couple of ridges underneath the tongue, and there's a little bulge there, and another ridge here, and a little bulge there. And I remember when we get bored in college or high school, we'd all lift our tongues in unison and do what?
Gleek.
Gleek.
Do it.
Gleek.
I can't do it.
You gleek out Wharton's duct. You're trying to squirt the professor in the front of the room. And there were some good gleekers, boy. I remember
mostly girls.
I can't do it anymore because I don't know the life of it. You compress your tongue in such a way that you use those out Wharton's duct out of the end of here. And I had an English professor, actually, an English teacher in high school. She got so excited about Silas Marner and, you know, all these old stories, and she would gleek all over everybody in the front room. I did that a while ago, accidentally. I wore a towel in class one day. She was wondering, why was I wearing this towel? Even gleek, if you're a good gleeker, you can see. It's a compound tubular alveolar gland, and it has both mucus and serous acid. There's more serous, probably, and less mucus. And there is submandibular gland, which I hope you've seen already. What are the characteristics of mucus cells here? White, and the nucleus? Flat. White cells, flat nucleus. And the vascular cells have these beautiful over here, a beautiful round nucleus, beautiful round nucleus. So, lingual gland. And what's this thing called here, made up of some serous cells sitting on top of the acinus like a baseball cap? Demilune, serous SD, serous demilune is probably an artifact. And sublingual gland, of course, this could have been a region of the, this could have been on the left, it could have been a region of the submandibular gland, but I don't think so, because there's too many mucus aspects. This clearly is submandibular gland over here, because there's mucus in the dark serous. Unfortunately, your slides didn't show serous very, very dark, did it? That was a problem. So where's the sublingual gland? Under the tongue. Well, what is leaking? The sublingual gland under the tongue also dumped into Wharton's duct. So you not only gleek from the sublingual, but you gleek from the submandibular gland as well, because both glands use Wharton's duct to dump juice out at the end. We'll see mostly mucus acini, and we'll see some serous demilune. Now, what are some salivary secretions? Well, salivary amylase, do we use it very much? No, we don't chew our food very well, do we? Because we're in too much of a hurry. Well, maybe not you guys, but the general public is too much in a hurry, and so we don't chew our food, we don't mix the amylase very well, so it probably doesn't do the job that it should be doing. We also have lysozyme, like in cells. Dogs have a lot of that. You know, they have strong. and we have lots of secretory IgA. The interesting story is that the lymphocytes in the gut, in Peyer's patches, migrate all the way to the salivary gland. That was a revolutionary discovery, that the lymphocytes in Peyer's patches have connections with the salivary gland. Okay, we have to stop now. Next time we meet, we're going to begin discussion of pancreas and liver. That'll be the last day. Pancreas.